Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of February 4th, 2020. Goodbye, Iowa. We don't care about your state fair or your corn dogs or whatever until 2023. Maybe? We held this week's podcast to bring you a South Carolina focus on the results of the 2020 Iowa caucuses that declared, oh, wait a minute, nope, we still have no idea who the winner is in Iowa. Yeah, super duper. But even with all this confusion, there are still ramifications for the Palmetto State. We look at who the winners and losers are for South Carolina with reporters Meg Kennard and Jamie Lovegrove, who are here to navigate this with us. Also, mark your calendars, Charleston. The Lead will be taping live at Holy City Brewing on March 5th at 6:30 p.m. We're going to have a snake alarm party. Come on out and show us some low country love, grab some swag, participate in some giveaways, recover from your primary hangover, and catch up on the latest with the state's top political reporters. Again, Holy City Brewing, March 5th, 6:30 p.m. Snake alarms. RSVP online. You can interact with us on Twitter or Instagram at SCLeadPod. We always want to hear from you, so holler at us with your thoughts on social media. Our DMs are always open. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. And make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, where you can rate and review us. We're also everywhere podcasts exist, including NPR One. You can listen to all four sections of our podcast while you realize The Bachelor has a more reliable voting system than the Iowa caucuses. Will Mayor Pete get the rose? Or Bernie Sanders? Or while you try to convince your friends not to worry about the coronavirus and instead just to wash your hands because the flu is still raging in South Carolina. 51 people have died here, guys. That is much worse than the coronavirus in South Carolina. And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present. But here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the AP reports that white supremacist Dylan Roof appealed his federal conviction and death sentence in the 2015 massacre of 9 black church members at the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, arguing that he was mentally ill when he represented himself at his capital trial. The federal jury convicted Roof of 33 federal charges, including hate crimes. During a separate proceeding in state court, Roof was given 9 life sentences in exchange for his guilty plea. Roof's appellate lawyers said Roof had been diagnosed with schizophrenia spectrum disorder, autism, anxiety, and depression, but that he, quote, jettisoned his experienced trial lawyers to stop them from presenting evidence of his mental illness to jurors. Number two, the Post and Courier reports that the Charleston County Aviation Authority voted to offer a contract to Elliot Sumi to become the authority's new CEO at a salary of $290,000 a year. Sumi is the son of North Charleston Mayor Keith Sumi and is chairman of Charleston County Council. The deal was approved by a vote of 6-2, with one board member resigning before the meeting due to the closed nature of Sumi's selection. The 1970 law that set up the Aviation Authority does not require the agency to perform an open search for that CEO position. Number three, Republican State Representative Micah Caskey of West Columbia dubbed last week, quote, embarrassing for Governor Henry McMaster's office since his nominees for the Department of Public Safety and the new Veterans Affairs Department had to withdraw due to improper vetting, essentially. The Post and Courier reported that a law prevents State Representative Bobby Cox to run the Veterans Affairs Department since he previously voted to help create it. And North Charleston Police Chief Reggie Burgess bowed out of consideration for the DPS job, citing strain on his family in an application mishap dealing with a tax lien from 2007 to 2012. And number four, the state newspaper reports that Judge Gene Toll has set April 20th for what could be one of the biggest trials in state history, deciding whether state-owned utility Santee Cooper should refund possibly billions of dollars to some 2.2 million ratepayers. The trial involving the $9 billion failed V.C. Summer nuclear project was a victory for Santee Cooper's ratepayers, who have been certified to join together to sue the utility, and whose lawyers had been pushing for more time to prepare their case. The jury trial will take place in Greenville. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Every week we give you a headline, a little taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. Headline: Florida Man uses Wisconsin woman's debit card information to buy pizza. And not just one pizza, folks, but $68 worth of pizza at Little Caesars. That's a lot. And just like the baby nut, wait, what? We're talking about the baby nut? I don't want this. I'm not doing this. We'll just bury the lead! Monday was supposed to be the night. The night when we left it all behind and things changed. Like that one party in that coming-of-age movie when everything changes. But just like in that movie, everything went horribly wrong at the party, and nothing changed the next day, even as the seven main characters went back to high school and saw each other in the hallways. The name of this movie is the 2020 Iowa Caucuses. It featured some $50 million in advertising, more than a year of promotion, hundreds of crew members, and a tech glitch that messed up what was supposed to be a momentum boost for some and a reality check for others. We were planning on drilling down into the Iowa caucus data to try and surmise what it means for South Carolina today, but since apparently the app used by precinct managers to feed in data crashed, and then this technology called landline phones also failed, we don't have any data right now to talk about. So here to help us navigate what the heck happened in the Hawkeye State is Meg Knarr with the Associated Press and Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I would not want to be with anyone else right now.
We are blessed to be here.
It is such a joy.
This is a safe place. Jamie, before we start, I see you wrote on your piece of paper, Iowa caucus results, and what do you have there?
I've been breaking them down. And
looking at a blank sheet of paper.
I went to bed at midnight last night. I woke up at 5:30, and the situation was exactly the same.
Incredible.
It's wild how little
That's
can
so
change
wild.
In several hours. But we are currently sitting at, by my count, a very, very close tie. Mm. Every single candidate is at zero.
Wow.
So this is neck and neck. Really exciting stuff. And you can't make up a more thrilling story here.
I mean,
really
this
exciting.
Is the exclusive content we have on the lead here, guys. But Meg, yeah, South Carolinians, like Jamie was saying, woke up to a blank sheet of paper this morning. There were no clear results. You were on the AP desk last night really compiling all these latest developments as they were coming in from Iowa. Mm-hmm. You were like ground zero, basically. So kind of give us an overview again for people that are just trying to make sense of this. What happened and what you were seeing coming in from your colleagues in Iowa?
We're accustomed to the Iowa caucus night being a little bit different, right? It's not a typical process. It's certainly not one that we're accustomed to here in South Carolina, where we have traditional voting primaries. Mm-hmm. But the caucuses are kind of exciting. You see on cable television all kinds of correspondents wandering around these high school gymnasiums, going over to the separate groups of people that have kind of gathered together to physically represent support for the candidates that they like. But then, you know, they go through this whole alignment process where mm-hmm. they pick one, and then if nobody gets over a certain percentage, then they can pick another one. And it's just kind of an amorphous sort of moving event. And so we're watching that happen. And it gets to a point in the evening after the caucus has been going on for about an hour, 2 hours, you expect to have the data. You think, okay, well, this alignment and realignment has happened. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to start to see some numbers. And we didn't.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it's 10 o'clock and we're thinking back to 2016. And, you know, we had all the information by this time 4 years ago. What has happened? Mm-hmm. And so then that kind of devolved into the process of where we are, which is waking up the next day with no real information on who won.
And that was going to be the big thing, too. We talked about this and you were really big on tweeting out, like, you know, the AP will call based on like state delegate equivalents because, mm-hmm. you know, there's the first alignment and then there's the final alignment, which is when people reshuffle if their candidate didn't get to 15%,
right.
like you're saying, and then state delegate equivalents. So we have none of that information right now. So no one can even spin anything at this point. And I saw a tweet from Lisa Desjardins with the PBS NewsHour who put it this way. She says, it's a great night to come in second, third, and fourth place in Iowa. And we heard speeches from people talking mm-hmm. about, you know, hey, you know, we're all going to go on to New Hampshire, even though there's no real momentum from Iowa at this
point. It was pretty much a great night for just about anybody who competed in the Iowa caucuses,
yeah.
because while no one could claim victory, that means that no one was a clear loser either. And so for those top four candidates who have been competing and generally placing among the top in the surveys and voters that have been talked to out in Iowa, all of those four candidates had very positive messages at the end of the evening. But only really one of them, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, came saying, I'm going to be going into New Hampshire, and I think we're going to be victorious. Mm-hmm. And so that was pretty much the strongest reaction from any of those four candidates. But, I mean, you know, so far it looks like pretty much everybody had a great night because no one clearly had an awful night.
Yeah. We all get a participation trophy, Jamie.
Yeah, I think that's true, especially for the candidates like Biden. Mm-hmm. And if you look further down the line, Warren and folks who yeah. it does not look like we're going to come out on top, Klobuchar,
yeah.
Who invests a lot of time there. Mm-hmm. I will say I think the folks, there are a couple of folks who I think, one in particular, who really suffered from this, which is Buttigieg.
Yeah.
all the other candidates have a, especially Bernie. So, you know, the first thing you would say is, oh, this is terrible for Bernie because it looks like he probably was going to be the winner. It's, you know, we'll see. Maybe I'm going to sound wrong about that in a few hours. But it looks like based on the early caucuses that he was probably going to be the winner. Mm-hmm. So you say, oh, that's terrible for him. The difference is Bernie is probably going to win New Hampshire.
Yeah.
He has a base of support all over the country. He's an extremely well-known national figure. Buttigieg is still introducing himself to a lot of the country outside of the first four states, mm-hmm. and he was really, really banking on Iowa to give him a platform to propel himself into national recognition.
Right.
So to not have that, even if he may have ended up coming in second, he might have won. If he was going to win, that
what
is
a huge boost.
Humongous,
and again, that goes back to what we're saying. Like,
disaster that he was not able to get that for his campaign.
So
I think
disaster,
he's the one.
Yeah.
He's the one real loser I see in the situation.
Even
he's been quite clear, you know, in South Carolina. I think we've all been a little skeptical of this because we know that Iowa, no matter what the results are never going to save someone's campaign or launch them necessarily into South Carolina contention. But he's been pretty clear that that's how he views it.
Mm-hmm.
When he comes here, he says, you know, look, I'm still introducing myself to black voters. And part of what is going to give me the viability argument, the electability argument, is mm-hmm. winning in Iowa and showing that I can do well there. So the fact that he's now not going to be able to point to that, that's a real tough blow for him that none of the other candidates quite face to the same degree.
Yeah, and that's something, like, again, like they were trying to make victory out of this because he did hear from about 80% of their precinct captains, and mm-hmm. they did have a pretty firm grasp, because even though we have the numbers from the Iowa Democratic Party, there are captains in all these precincts, mm-hmm. and they all know what's going
right.
on there.
And
so
they're
keeping
very close track, right?
And so, but going
and
back
I,
to what
can,
Jane was saying.
I can tell you, by the way, from one precinct captain, one precinct captain in Altoona last night, State Senator Dick Harpootlian of Columbia, his reaction is not fit for a family program.
Not fit for broadcast.
But yeah, I mean, going back to, again, what the whole point of Iowa was and what it means for South Carolina is momentum, right? Momentum for these early voting states. And when you're someone like Pete, like Jane was saying, you're not getting that front page treatment. You're not getting the
right.
breathless news cycle.
That's right.
Because right now on CNN, we're talking about Trump's impeachment and the State of the Union address. We're not talking about what happened in Iowa besides, oh, we're still waiting to find out what these results are. I mean, it's a huge disaster.
That's right. And that transference between Iowa and New Hampshire is long traditionally been a very direct pathway, literally.
Mm-hmm.
These candidates, the reporters covering them, they're staffs, they get on planes as soon as the Iowa caucus results come out, and they go straight to New Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
where they have some sort of a rally. The victor will certainly have a large rally, a big event, and there's all these people waiting at the airport. And we've seen that happen for years and years and years. And last night, there were still people going up to New Hampshire because they already had events scheduled, some
right.
for very, very early this morning.
Yeah.
But it's not quite that same energy. And sure, they're going to be finding, you know, plenty of other ways to do their campaigning and stuff. But exactly like Jamie was saying, it's a different playing field when you don't have that one mm-hmm. candidate or even a couple of candidates. And we've been talking for weeks about how it's not just a first place finish in Iowa
mm-hmm.
that can have implications for how voters view those candidates going into the other early voting states. There are plenty up for grabs, but now there's really no clear idea of
well, and
who
we,
even came
and we were
in
expecting
there.
Them to be spinning all that
that's
data
right.
too,
yes.
like the first round,
absolutely.
The final round.
They don't even
the
have anything to
I mean, they
spin.
Can't do anything.
I mean,
like, everyone
amazing.
Was going to be a winner, but now
that's
everyone's,
right.
everyone kind of is a winner, even
I mean,
though they're not.
So
know?
Much data to have come out of last
mm-hmm.
night, knowing
right.
who was going to be those first selections in the very first bunch of the alignment, as they call it. And then for the second round, who was actually, you know, where were those voters going whose
mm-hmm.
candidate didn't really make it? And then ultimately, like you said, the state delegate equivalents that organizations like the AP base our call off of.
Mm-hmm.
There was going to be a lot of information, and we expected candidates to be kind of picking and choosing which bunch of it looked best for them. But we didn't even have that.
What I would also just, you know, the level of disaster for the Iowa Democratic Party mm-hmm. here is hard to overstate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've all witnessed history here because we have, I guarantee you, you can mark my words on this one and hold
Holy
me to account if it does not happen. We just witnessed the last Iowa caucuses.
Wow.
At least the last Democratic
okay.
Iowa caucuses, and definitely the last Iowa caucuses going first. One of three scenarios are going to happen here. I was talking last night with some DNC members from South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
you know, these folks are voting. They were saying there's absolutely no chance in the world that Iowa is going to be first with the caucuses again.
Mm-hmm.
Zero chance. The three scenarios really are they change to a primary and they go first.
What's
several
New
reasons why that's unlikely,
yeah,
because New Hampshire is going to have some
right.
strong words about that. They keep the caucus and go later in the calendar, or they change to a primary and still go later in the calendar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably the third is the most likely.
Yeah.
But regardless, you know, so we have seen a little piece of history here. But the reason why it's so terrible and the reason why the campaigns, I can imagine, are just infuriated is because this is you have a 24-hour window to shape the course of the nation's history.
Yeah.
I mean, tonight is the State of the Union. All the news is going to be on that. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, the president is likely to be acquitted in his impeachment trial, in case you forgot that that's going on.
Mm-hmm. Something will happen on
We've
Thursday.
Got a debate
the debate's
in a few
on Friday.
Days.
I mean, like, it's just
New Hampshire
it's
after that.
On. Yeah.
I mean, you had one night. You had Monday night to make a serious impact on this race. And the window is, we're a couple hours away here from really closing this window. And even if we find out the results later today, the impact that they're going to have, I think, is really negligible at this point. So, you know, there were millions and millions of dollars spent in this state. There were huge amounts of time and resources and volunteers dedicated to that state. And, you know, I can't even imagine how frustrating that must be for those folks.
So then what, I mean, what does that really mean for South Carolina then? I mean, does much change at this point? Or we're just kind of like, okay, we're going to go see what happens in New Hampshire, which has already been kind of a foregone conclusion. We were really trying to see where the field was going to shape up, if there was going to be some winnowing in Iowa, and now we're just trudging on like nothing happened because right now nothing has happened.
Yeah, I mean, and so far, you know, with the inability for someone to really claim victory, and even when they can, like Jamie said, even when we do get that data, even when we know for sure, that does have implications. And I think what we're going to be seeing a lot of, regardless of what the numbers say, is a lot of spin and a lot of, well, you know, this is still our, for Biden, for example. I mean, I know his campaign is going to be saying this has always been the place that we figured that we would be performing the most strongly. This is where we have the longest relations, et cetera. You're going to see people like Tom Steyer, frankly, who've been investing a lot of time and energy in South Carolina. You're going to see him saying, oh, well, you know, who cares about Iowa? Like, this is the place where I've really been campaigning. Right. So all of that, all the things that we here have been seeing on the ground for over a year now, those are going to come up far more strongly, I think, in the next couple of weeks, regardless of what Iowa
Yeah, because that's
say.
What the news cycle is now. It's like, we can blow off Iowa. We don't have to worry about those results, especially if you're someone like Joe Biden, who wasn't expected to be doing fairly well there and, you know, wants to keep that message. Like, and we have momentum and we're still strong in other places like
in
South Carolina.
In South Carolina, I would say the two winners from last night are Biden and Steyer, because basically if you can have a no impact result out of Iowa, those are the two folks who are currently, it sure looks like, in this kind of top three to maybe four way race. Really, that's what we've got in South Carolina right now. It would take a comeback of historic proportions, really unprecedented for anyone other than Joe Biden, Tom Steyer, Bernie Sanders, or Elizabeth Warren to win in South Carolina right now. So Bernie obviously would have gotten a boost if he had won Iowa. It certainly can't hurt at the very least. Whether or not it would have had a significant impact, it's kind of hard to say. I think we were all under the impression going in that it probably was not going to completely change the game. But for Biden and Steyer, you know, the fact that they get to keep the status quo, that's pretty good for
them. Because it was going to start really beginning that pressure on Biden, which everyone's going to be like, you know, he's going to have all this pressure in Iowa and New Hampshire. And then, you know, try and pull something in Nevada and then also South Carolina, where he has to hold this line, hold his firewall. But, you know, if he was going to come in fourth in Iowa and, you know, not so great in New Hampshire, it's like this pressure was going to start building. That's where it was going to begin. And now his campaign is just like, they're questioning everything about the Iowa process right now. So who knows, even if we get these results this afternoon, if they're going to want to believe those or want them to be, you know, evaluated and audited. I mean, this is not going to just end this afternoon, I don't think.
And, you know, one thing I've just got to point out. So for many, many months, we've been asking, the three of us in here have been asking directly of these candidates when we see them, you know, what does it mean for you to finish in place XYZ in Iowa or New Hampshire? But mostly we focused on Iowa since it goes first. And we've heard various answers from the candidates. Most of it has been kind of a measuring expectations, like we have heard from the Biden camp directly. Isn't that funny how none of that matters right now? I mean, we're still going to get the information, but, you know, as we've all been saying, it's just really going to be viewed much more differently. And so now these campaigns, especially competing here in South Carolina for Biden and Steyer in particularly, they can really start from a different kind of not ground level, but a different level in terms of saying, okay, well, here's our argument. Here's the same thing we've been saying, and we're just going to make it anew here in South Carolina.
Which is important, Jamie, when you look at the Post and Courier Change Research poll that just came out this weekend. When you do see Bernie Sanders making inroads on Joe Biden's numbers, Biden at 25%, Bernie at 20%, Steyer cementing that third place lead now at 18%. I mean, that that kind of gives them the ability to be like, you know, to kind of focus on those numbers and not so much worry about what happened in other states.
Sure. I mean, for one, I would just say I'm not sure that Bernie's actually chipping into Biden's lead per se. Warren went down. So we don't know which voters are going where, but one might infer from that Warren is losing supporters to Bernie, mm-hmm. and the person Biden is losing supporters to is Steyer. The reason we might want to think that is because specifically when you look at black voters, mm-hmm. Steyer has made significant ground. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's surprising, again, to any of us who are on the ground because of how much Steyer has, yes, invested on mm-hmm. TV and on digital, but also with a humongous field program mm-hmm. all over the state.
Very
you
talked
to, you know, so we last week, I thought actually, you know, obviously a lot of people pay attention to polls and they paid attention to our poll. I thought the more revealing story that we worked on last week was calling all 46 mm-hmm. county chairs. I think mm-hmm. 35 of them were willing to give us their take on what's going on in their counties. All over the state, people are saying, you know, I kind of been looking at these three or four, you know, Biden, Buttigieg, Warren, Bernie. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Steyer is really making mm-hmm. ground. Like, he's really engaging with a lot of folks in the community. He has won over a lot of sort of validators in the black community who are making the rounds for him. He's invested a huge amount, working on something about this later. You can see in his FEC filing, huge amounts in black-owned media.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At least $500,000 from the last time I read.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's
so that makes an impact. So, you know, people are particularly outside of South Carolina are, you know, shocked by this. And I don't think anyone who spent more than 5 minutes here or who owns a television or who lives in many of these communities would be surprised.
But Megan, you're covering Steyer more mm-hmm. and more for AP now, but I'm wondering, you know, when we look at that, we've been talking about this, you know, great, he's doing third place Saul here in South mm-hmm. Carolina, then there's Super Tuesday, and then he's in single digits in these other places. I'm just wondering what the end game is at that point.
Sure.
Besides just winning South Carolina.
It is hard
third
to,
place
no,
in South Carolina.
It's hard to know exactly mm-hmm. like we were talking about Iowa. You know, it was very hard for us to know exactly what impacts that was going to have. And it is hard to know what happens after South Carolina for a campaign like Tom Steyer, who, we, as Jamie was just saying, has been investing very heavily here in South Carolina mm-hmm. and spending a lot of time, a lot of money, and developing what appear to be some pretty genuine connections with a lot of people here. But I'm not forecasting what's going to happen this cycle, certainly, or cycles to come. But I just want you to keep one thing in mind. Tom Steyer is 62 years old. Mm-hmm. In our current Democratic field, that is very young, actually. So I'm just suggesting that perhaps what we've been seeing is Tom Steyer laying groundwork for yeah. what could be to come. Maybe yeah. this isn't his cycle, yeah. but maybe he's been getting a lot of people's attention and introducing himself. So then the next time it comes around, he won't need to go through that. Like Bernie yeah. Sanders didn't have to do this year and was already very well known. Again, I'm not predicting anything, yeah. but I am just taking note that sometimes we do see that, particularly with candidates who, you know, aren't quite at the top of the field age-wise.
And there
yet.
Was always talk about whether or not he's interested in running for other offices.
Governor
Senate
of California.
California
mm-hmm.
Governor,
Senate.
Senate.
Right.
You know, Dianne Feinstein's pretty old.
I mean, it depends on who
California
you ask.
California senator. Yeah.
Right. And just to put in perspective, like, yes, third in South Carolina is strong, but then when you look at the morning consult polls for, you know, Super
sure.
Tuesday. I mean, Bloomberg is ahead of him, you know, so it's
and Mike Bloomberg has been investing incredibly heavily
have
in all of the Super Tuesday.
I mean, that is you know, if we want to speak more broadly, that is clearly the Steyer problem right now,
yeah.
is that even if he comes out of South Carolina with a huge boost, he's mm-hmm. about to run into a wall of money from Bloomberg.
He is going
to experience what the entire rest of the field is experiencing with him right now.
Yeah.
You know, Bloomberg, I've said
it's like
this
the
before,
Russian dolls, you know. There's one, and then there's a bigger
there's
one, and then
richer,
there's a bigger
richer billionaires
one.
Right.
on the inside.
I mean, Bloomberg, really, we cannot overstate how much wealthier Bloomberg mm-hmm. is than Steyer. It's, you know, 30 to 40 times. He is like $60 billion to Steyer's two or three. In some ways, it is a fascinating sort of rich billionaire versus poor billionaire mm-hmm. strategy difference there. You know, the one who has $1 billion is a lot of money, but the one who has fewer resources might want to focus on these four early states where mm-hmm. you can get cheaper media,
yeah. mm-hmm.
you can make more of an impact, you only have a few, you know, areas to get around and mm-hmm. fewer voters to win over. The rich billionaire strategy is to do that, but nationwide. And that is what Bloomberg is doing. And so, you know, they're different candidates. Bloomberg is obviously a lot more moderate than Tom Steyer is and is running on a lot more moderate platform. So mm-hmm. it's not like it's just two billionaires and that's the only,
lots
you know.
Lots of ideological differences.
There's lots of ideological differences. But again, when money is playing such a big role in these races, that's going to be hard for Steyer to overcome after South Carolina.
So there's still a lot of unknowns. We've been talking. Hopefully people can get some understanding about what's going on out there. We're going to have more next week, obviously, and going forward. We still have no results, and we're taping as of 9:47, so this podcast may change by the time you hear it. So, yes. But mark your calendars. The New Hampshire primary
Hopefully
is February 11th.
Honestly, by the time
I mean,
hear.
Who knows? As long as you're listening as soon as this drops. But the New Hampshire primaries next Tuesday. We'll be talking about that next week. Hopefully there'll be results to talk about
that
next week.
That would be wonderful.
But thank you again to Meg Kennard with the AP and Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier. You can also follow them on Twitter at Meg Kennard AP and JS Lovegrove. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gavin.
It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020 related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. And we got some new poll data that we're going to start off with. Woo! That's right. The latest Post and Courier Change Research poll released Sunday shows former Vice President Joe Biden with 25% support. And this is just a 5-point lead over Senator Bernie Sanders. Tom Steyer is cementing that support we saw in that Fox News poll and remains in third with 18%. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has 11%, and former Mayor Pete Buttigieg rounds out at 7%. The poll surveyed 651 likely South Carolina Democratic 2020 presidential primary voters from January 26th to January 29th, with a margin of error of plus or minus 4%. Greenwood County Councilwoman Edith Childs, the woman who popularized the Fired Up and Ready to Go slogan and chant of Barack Obama's 2008 presidential bid, has backed Tom Steyer and is being featured in a Tom Steyer ad, this according to the Associated Press. And if you haven't seen a Tom Steyer ad yet, don't worry, they'll find you. The state newspaper reports that Mo Brown, a former USC wide receiver who worked 6 years at the South Carolina Department of Commerce, is running as a Democrat for the 5th Congressional District seat, currently occupied by Republican Representative Ralph Norman. Two other Democrats are running, but have not raised money yet, according to federal records. Democrat Joe Cunningham came out with his first 2020 campaign ad on TV, hitting back against dark money attacks by the American Action Network, and focus on his dedication to the 1st Congressional District. This complete with a photo of him and Republican Governor Henry McMaster shaking hands at an anti-offshore drilling event. And a little impeachment update. Both Senators Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott voted against allowing witnesses to testify before the Senate trial, which is now expected to wrap up this week, possibly around Wednesday, with President Donald Trump's acquittal. And just a little heads up for next week, we'll have some Federal Election Commission numbers for you in the campaign trail next week. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here with some state trivia for us? Russ,
yes.
Welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
How's it going? What do we got?
Okay. Well, did you know our question this week is, where was the infamous Sunset Lodge?
Ooh. Wait, I don't know.
Well, this, you should know this. The Sunset Lodge was an internationally known brothel.
I should know. Thank you, Russ.
And it operated from 1936 until 1969. It was something that was very well known across the state, especially in political circles.
Oh, Jesus.
As a
different
brothel.
Days.
So our question is, where was the infamous Sunset Lodge? A, Georgetown. B, Conway. C, North Myrtle Beach. D, Goose Creek.
Yeah, I'm definitely coastal. I mean, you're thinking Sunset, you're thinking of, you know, seafarers.
Georgetown,
okay.
Conway, North Myrtle Beach, Goose Creek.
I mean, you're really kneeling there with that, sorry, with the Horry County stuff. Then, of course, this Goose Creek is just such a, but Goose Creek is, yeah, I know, like maybe it's tucked away, Goose Creek before it was what it is. It's still, Myrtle Beach, I think, would be a little on, I would say on the nose. I don't want to apologize to Horry County listeners. We can cut that. Conway is the gateway to Myrtle Beach. Could be a gateway to other things. I don't know. But, you know, we're talking about the 30s through the 60s. Things were different everywhere. Ah.
The sheriff closed the establishment in 1969. The sheriff of a county where the Sunset Lodge was located.
I'm going to do Goose Creek. But I also want to do Georgetown.
Well, the answer is A, Georgetown. The Sunset Lodge was located on U.S. Highway 17 just outside of the city limits of Georgetown. Okay. It was, and as I mentioned, it was very well known, especially in kind of the political circles of South Carolina. And one thing it was known for was back in the day, way back in the day, is a lot of Major League Baseball clubs doing spring training in Florida on the way back would make a stop off in Georgetown and perhaps visit the Sunset Lodge. Tom Yawkey, the multimillionaire who owned a plantation in South Carolina, also owned the Boston Red Sox. So there's a close. There was a close connection between the Red Sox and the Sunset Lodge.
Wow!
And it was known for the owner, the woman who managed this establishment or owned it, was known for dispensing cash Christmas gifts to law enforcement officers every year. But again, the high sheriff of Georgetown County closed the Sunset Lodge down in 1969. The late Bob Pierce, an editor of the state newspaper, writing in the South Carolina Encyclopedia, said that interesting note concerning the Sunset Lodge was that 1 week during the spring every year, the Sunset Lodge was only available to members of the General Assembly.
Oh, my God. You know, bipartisanship the old-fashioned way, I suppose. Ah, well, you know, we don't condone human trafficking or anything of this sort of ilk, but a very interesting look back at the Sunset Lodge and the storied Sunset Lodge there in Georgetown. Thanks, Russ.
Sure.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, Spotify, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram at SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to SCLEDE at SCETV.org. LMNOP. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Associated Press and the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Amy Crouch is our supervising producer. Sean Birch and Tom Posey are our executive producers. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on February 3rd, 2020. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. Welcome to February, month of the leap year dad jokes. I'm not 40, I'm only 10.
Ah! Do you watch that. The Bachelor?
Maybe I should. So, yes, A. Okay.